Yes, Lestat could kill and drink like a bolt of lightning, but I had saved only Babette's physical life. I was not to know that until later. In an hour and a half, Lestat and I were in New Orleans. The horses nearly dead from exhaustion, the carriage parked on a side street a block from a new Spanish hotel. Lestat had an old man by the arm, and was putting $50 into his hand. "Get us a suite," he directed him, "and order some champagne. Say it is for two gentlemen and pay in advance, and when you come back I'll have another $50 for you. And I'll be watching for you, I wager." His gleaming eyes held the man in thrall. I knew he'd kill him as soon as he returned with the hotel room keys. And he did. I sat in the carriage, watching wearily as the man grew weaker and weaker and finally died, his body collapsing like a sack of rocks in a doorway as Lestat let him go. "Good night, sweet prince," said Lestat. "And here's your $50. And he shoved the money into his pocket as if it were a capital joke. Now we slipped in the courtyard doors of the hotel, and went up to the lavish parlor of our suite. Champagne glistened in a frosted bucket. Two glasses stood on the silver tray. I knew Lestat would fill one glass and sit there staring at the pale yellow color. And I, a man in a trance, lay on the settee staring at him as if nothing he could do mattered. "I have to leave him or die," I thought. "It would be sweet to die," I thought. Yes, die. I wanted to die before. Now I wish to die. I saw it with such sweet clarity, such dead calm. "You're being morbid," Lestat said suddenly. "It's almost dawn." He pulled the lace curtains back, and I could see the rooftops under the dark blue sky and above the great constellation Orion. "Go kill," said Lestat, sliding up the glass. He stepped out of the sill, and I heard his feet land softly on the rooftop beside the hotel. He was going for the coffins, or at least one. My thirst rose in me like fever, and I followed him. My desire to die was constant, like a pure thought in the mind, devoid of emotion, yet I needed to feed. I've indicated to you I would not then kill people. I moved along the rooftop in search of rats. "But why? You said Lestat shouldn't have made you start with people. Do you mean for you it was an aesthetic choice, not a moral one?" "Had you asked me then, I would have told you it was aesthetic, that I wished to understand death in stages, that the death of an animal yielded such pleasure and experience to me that I had only begun to understand it, and wished to save the experience of human death for my mature understanding. But it was moral, because all aesthetic decisions are moral, really." "I don't understand," said the boy. "I thought aesthetic decisions could be completely immoral. What about the cliché of the artist who leaves his wife and children so he can paint? Or Nero playing the harp while Rome burned?" "Both were moral decisions. Both served a higher good in the mind of the artist. The conflict lies between the morals of the artist and the morals of society, not between aesthetics and morality. But often this isn't understood. And here comes the waste, the tragedy. An artist stealing paints from a store, for example, imagines himself to have made an inevitable but immoral decision, and then he sees himself as fallen from grace. What follows is despair and petty irresponsibility, as if morality were a great glass world which can be utterly shattered by one act. But this was not my great concern then. I did not know these things then. I believed I killed animals for aesthetic reasons only, and I hedged against the great moral question of whether or not by my very nature I was damned. Because, you see, though Lestat had never said anything about devils or hell to me, I believed I was damned when I went over to him, just as Judas might have believed it when he put the noose around his neck. You understand?" The boy said nothing. He started to speak, but didn't. The color burned for a moment in blotches on his cheeks.
"Were you?" he whispered.
The vampire only sat there, smiling, a small smile that played on his lips like the light. The boy was staring at him now as if he were just seeing him for the first time.
"Perhaps," said the vampire, drawing himself up and crossing his legs, "we should take things one at a time. Perhaps I should go on with my story."
"Yes, please," said the boy.
"I was agitated that night, as I told you. I had hedged against this question as a vampire, and now it completely overwhelmed me. And in that state I had no desire to live. Well, this produced in me, as it can in humans, a craving for that which will satisfy at least physical desire. I think I used it as an excuse. I have told you what the kill means to vampires. You can imagine from what I've said the difference between a rat and a man. I went down into the street after Lestat and walked for blocks. The streets were muddy than the actual blocks, islands above the gutters, and the entire city so dark compared to the cities of today. The lights were as beacons in a black sea. Even with morning rising slowly, only the dormers and high porches of the houses were emerging from the dark, and to a mortal man the narrow streets I found were like pitch. Am I damned? Am I from the devil? Is my very nature that of a devil? I was asking myself over and over. And if it is, why then do I revolt against it? Tremble when Babette hurls a flaming lantern at me, turn away in disgust when Lestat kills. What have I become in becoming a vampire? Where am I to go? And all the while, as the death wish caused me to neglect my thirst grew hotter. My veins were veritable threads of pain in my flesh. My temples throbbed. And finally I could stand it no longer. Torn apart by the wish to take no action, to starve, to wither in thought on the one hand, and driven to kill on the other, I stood in an empty, desolate street and heard the sound of a child crying. She was within. I drew close to the walls, trying in my habitual detachment only to understand the nature of her cry. She was weary and aching and utterly alone. She had been crying for so long now that soon she would stop from sheer exhaustion. I slipped my hand up under the heavy wooden shutter and pulled it so the bolt slipped. There she sat, in the dark room beside a dead woman, a woman who'd been dead for some days. The room itself was cluttered with trunks and packages, as though a number of people had been packing to leave, but the mother lay half-clothed, her body already in decay. And no one else was there but the child. It was moments before she saw me, but when she did, she began to tell me that I must do something to help her mother. She was only 5, at most, and very thin, and her face was stained with dirt and tears. She begged me to help. They had to take a ship, she said, before the plague came. Their father was waiting. She began to shake her mother now and to cry in the most pathetic and desperate way, and then she looked at me again and burst into the greatest flow of tears. You must understand that by now I was burning with physical need to drink. I could not have made it through another day without feeding. But there were some alternatives. Rats abounded in the streets, and somewhere very near a dog was howling hopelessly. I might have fled the room had I chosen, and fed, and gotten back easily. But the question pounded in me, am I damned? If so, why do I feel such pity for her gaunt face? Why do I wish to touch her tiny soft arms, hold her now on my knee as I am doing, feel her bend her head to my chest as I gently touch the satin hair? Why do I do this? If I am damned, I must want to kill her. I must want to make her nothing but food for a cursed existence, because, being damned, I must hate her. And when I thought of this,
I saw Babette's face contorted with hatred when she had held the lantern waiting to light it, and I saw Lestat in my mind and hated him, and I felt, yes, damned, and this is hell, and in that instant I had bent down and driven hard into her soft, small neck, and hearing her tiny cry, whispered even as I felt the hot blood on my lips, "It's only for a moment, and there'll be no more pain." But she was locked to me, and I was soon incapable of saying anything. For 4 years I had not savored a human. For 4 years I hadn't really known, and now I heard her heart in that terrible rhythm, and such a heart. Not the heart of a man or an animal, but the rapid, tenacious heart of the child, beating harder and harder, refusing to die, beating like a tiny fist beating on a door, crying, "I will not die, I will not die, I cannot die, I cannot die." I think I rose to my feet, still locked to her, the heart pulling my heart faster with no hope of cease, the rich blood rushing too fast for me, the room reeling, and then, despite myself, I was staring over her bent head, her open mouth, down through the gloom at the mother's face, and through the half-masked lids her eyes gleamed at me as if they were alive. I threw the child down. She lay like a jointless doll. And turning in blind horror of the mother to flee, I saw the window filled with a familiar shape. It was Lestat, who backed away from it now, laughing, his body bent as he danced in the mud street. "Louis! Louis!" he taunted me, and pointed a long, bone-thin finger at me, as if to say he'd caught me in the act. And now he bounded over the sill, brushing me aside, and grabbed the mother's stinking body from the bed and made to dance with her. "Good God!" whispered the boy. "Yes, I might have said the same," said the vampire. He stumbled over the child as he pulled the mother along in widening circles, singing as he danced, her matted hair falling in her face as her head snapped back and a black fluid poured out of her mouth. He threw her down. I was out of the window and running down the street, and he was running after me. "Are you afraid of me, Louis?" he shouted. "Are you afraid? The child's alive, Louis. You left her breathing. Shall I go back and make her a vampire? We could use her, Louis, and think of all the pretty dresses we could buy for her. Louis, wait, Louis! I'll go back for her, if you say." And so he ran after me, all the way back to the hotel, all the way across the rooftops, where I hoped to lose him, until I leaped in the window of the parlor and turned in rage and slammed the window shut. He hit it, arms outstretched like a bird who seeks to fly through glass, and shook the frame. I was utterly out of my mind. I went round and round the room looking for some way to kill him. I pictured his body burnt to a crisp on the roof below. Reason had altogether left me, so that I was consummate rage. And when he came through the broken glass, we fought as we'd never fought before. It was hell that stopped me, the thought of hell, of us being two souls in hell that grappled in hatred. I lost my confidence, my purpose, my grip. I was down on the floor then, and he was standing over me, his eyes cold though his chest heaved. "You're a fool, Louis," he said. His voice was calm. It was so calm it brought me around. "The sun's coming up," he said, his chest heaving slightly from the struggle, his eyes narrow as he looked at the window. I'd never seen him quite like this. The fight had got the better of him in some way, or something had. "Get in your coffin," he said to me, without even the slightest anger, "but tomorrow night we talk." Well, I was more than slightly amazed. Lestat talk? I couldn't imagine this. Never had Lestat and I really talked. I think I have described to you with accuracy our sparring matches, our angry go-rounds. He was desperate for the money. "For your houses," said the boy.
Or was it that he was as afraid to be alone as you were?
These questions occurred to me. It even occurred to me that Lestat meant to kill me, some way that I didn't know. You see, I wasn't sure then why I awoke each evening when I did, whether it was automatic when the death-like sleep left me, and why it happened sometimes earlier than at other times. It was one of the things Lestat would not explain. And he was often up before me. He was my superior in all the mechanics, as I've indicated. And I shut the coffin that morning with a kind of despair. I should explain now, though, that the shutting of the coffin is always disturbing. It is rather like going under a modern anesthetic on an operating table. Even a casual mistake on the part of an intruder might mean death.
But how could he have killed you? He couldn't have exposed you to the light. He couldn't have stood it himself.
This is true. But rising before me, he might have nailed my coffin shut, or set it afire. The principal thing was, I didn't know what he might do, what he might know that I still did not know. But there was nothing to be done about it then, and with thoughts of the dead woman and child still in my brain and the sun rising, I had no energy left to argue with him and lay down to miserable dreams.
"You do dream," said the boy.
"Often," said the vampire. "I wish sometimes that I did not. For such dreams, such long and clear dreams I never had as a mortal, and such twisted nightmares I never had either. In my early days these dreams so absorbed me that often it seemed I fought waking as long as I could, and lay sometimes for hours thinking of these dreams until the night was half gone, and dazed by them I often wandered about, seeking to understand their meaning. They were in many ways as elusive as the dreams of mortals. I dreamed of my brother, for instance, that he was near me in some state between life and death, calling to me for help. And often I dreamed of Babette, and often, almost always, there was a great wasteland backdrop to my dreams, that wasteland of night I'd seen when cursed by Babette, as I've told you. It was as if all figures walked and talked on the desolate home of my damned soul. I don't remember what I dreamed that day, perhaps because I remember too well what Lestat and I discussed the following evening. I see you're anxious for that, too. Well, as I've said, Lestat amazed me in his new calm, his thoughtfulness. But that evening I didn't wake to find him the same way, not at first. There were women in the parlor. The candles were a few scattered on the small table in the carved buffet, and Lestat had his arm around one woman and was kissing her. She was very drunk and very beautiful, a great drugged doll of a woman with her careful coif falling slowly down on her bare shoulders and over her partially bared breasts. The other woman sat over a ruined supper table drinking a glass of wine. I could see that the three of them had dined. Lestat pretending to dine. You would be surprised how people do not notice that a vampire is only pretending to eat. And the woman at the table was bored. All this put me in a fit of agitation. I did not know what Lestat was up to. If I went into the room, the woman would turn her attentions to me. And what was to happen I couldn't imagine, except that Lestat meant for us to kill them both. The woman on the settee with him was already teasing about his kisses, his coldness, his lack of desire for her. And the woman at the table watched with black almond eyes that seemed to be filled with satisfaction. When Lestat rose and came to her, putting his hands on her bare white arms, she brightened. Bending now to kiss her, he saw me through the crack in the door, and his eyes just stared at me for a moment, and then he went on talking with the ladies. He bent down and blew out the candles on the table.
"It's too dark in here," said the woman on the couch. "Leave us alone," said the other woman.
Lestat sat down and beckoned her to sit in his lap, and she did, putting her left arm around his neck, her right hand smoothing back his yellow hair.
"'Your skin's icy,' she said, recoiling slightly. "'Not always,' said Lestat, and then he buried his face in the flesh of her neck. I was watching all this with fascination. Lestat was masterfully clever and utterly vicious, but I didn't know how clever he was until he sank his teeth into her now, his thumb pressing down on her throat, his other arm locking her tight, so that he drank his fill without the other woman even knowing. "'Your friend has no head for wine,' he said, slipping out of the chair and seating the unconscious woman there, her arms folded under her face on the table. "'She's stupid,' said the other woman, who'd gone to the window and had been looking out at the lights. New Orleans was then a city of many low buildings, as you probably know. And on such clear nights as this, the lamp-lit streets were beautiful from the high windows of this new Spanish hotel, and the stars of those days hung low over such dim light as they do at sea. "'I can warm that cold skin of yours better than she can.' She turned to Lestat, and I must confess I was feeling some relief that he would now take care of her as well. But he planned nothing so simple. "'Do you think so?' he said to her. He took her hand, and she said, "'Why, you're warm.' "'You mean the blood had warmed him?' said the boy. "'Oh, yes,' said the vampire. "'After killing, a vampire is as warm as you are now.' And he started to resume. Then, glancing at the boy, he smiled. "'As I was saying, Lestat now held the woman's hand in his and said that the other had warmed him. His face, of course, was flushed, much altered. He drew her close now, and she kissed him, remarking through her laughter that he was a veritable furnace of passion. "'Ah, but the price is high,' he said to her, affecting sadness. "'Your pretty friend,' he shrugged his shoulders, "'I exhausted her.' And he stood back, as if inviting the woman to walk to the table. And she did, a look of superiority on her small features. She bent down to see her friend, but then lost interest, until she saw something. It was a napkin. It had caught the last drops of blood from the wound in the throat. She picked it up, straining to see it in the darkness. "'Take down your hair,' said Lestat softly. And she dropped it, indifferent, and took down the last tresses, so that her hair fell blonde and wavy down her back. "'Soft,' he said. "'So soft. I picture you that way, lying on a bed of satin.' "'Such things you say,' she scoffed, and turned her back on him playfully. "'Do you know what manner of bed?' he asked. And she laughed and said his bed she could imagine. She looked back at him as he advanced, and, never once looking away from her, he gently tipped the body of her friend so that it fell backwards from the chair and lay with staring eyes upon the floor. The woman gasped. She scrambled away from the corpse, nearly upsetting a small end table. The candle went over and went out. "'Put out the light, and then put out the light,' Lestat said softly. And then he took her into his arms like a struggling moth and sank his teeth into her.
"'But what were you thinking as you watched?' asked the boy. "'Did you want to stop him the way you wanted to stop him from killing Frenier?'
"'No,' said the vampire. "'I could not have stopped him. And you must understand I knew that he killed humans every night. Animals gave him no satisfaction whatsoever.' Animals were to be banked on when all else failed, but never to be chosen. If I felt any sympathy for the women, it was buried deep in my own turmoil. I still felt in my chest the little hammer heart of that starving child. I still burned with the questions of my own divided nature. I was angry that Lestat had staged this show for me, waiting till I woke to kill the women, and I wondered again if I might somehow break loose from him and felt both hatred and my own weakness more than ever. Meantime, he propped their lovely corpses at the table and went about the room, lighting all the candles until it blazed as if for a wedding. "'Come in, Louis,' he said.
I would have arranged an escort for you, but I know what a man you are about choosing your own. Pity Mademoiselle Frenier likes to hurl flaming lanterns. It makes a party unwieldy, don't you think, especially for a hotel?
He seated the blonde-haired girl so that her head lay to one side against the damask back of the chair, and the darker woman lay with her chin resting just above her breasts. This one had blanched, and her features had a rigid look to them already, as though she was one of those women in whom the fire of personality makes beauty. But the other looked only as if she slept, and I was not sure that she was even dead. Lestat had made two gashes, one in her throat and one above her left breast, and both still bled freely. He lifted her wrist now, and slitting it with a knife, filled two wine glasses and bade me to sit down.
"I'm leaving you," I said to him at once. "I wish to tell you that now."
"I thought as much," he answered, sitting back in the chair. "And I thought as well that you would make a flowery announcement. Tell me what a monster I am, what a vulgar fiend."
"I make no judgments upon you. I'm not interested in you. I am interested in my own nature now, and I've come to believe I can't trust you to tell me the truth about it." "You use knowledge for personal power," I told him, and I suppose in the manner of many people making such an announcement I was not looking to him at all. I was mainly listening to my own words. But now I saw that his face was once again the way it had been when he'd said he would talk. He was listening to me. I was suddenly at a loss. I felt that gulf between us as painfully as ever.
"Why did you become a vampire?" I blurted out. "And why such a vampire as you are, vengeful and delighting in taking human life even when you have no need? This girl, why did you kill her when one would have done? And why did you frighten her so before you killed her? And why have you propped her here in some grotesque manner, as if tempting the gods to strike you down for your blasphemy?"
All this he listened to without speaking, and in the pause that followed I again felt at a loss. Lestat's eyes were large and thoughtful. I'd seen them that way before, but I couldn't remember when, certainly not when talking to me.
"What do you think a vampire is?" he asked me sincerely.
"I don't pretend to know."
"You pretend to know. What is it?"
I asked, and to this he answered nothing. It was as if he sensed the insincerity of it, the spite. He just sat there looking at me with the same still expression. Then I said, "I know that after leaving you I shall try to find out. I'll travel the world, if I have to find other vampires. I know they must exist. I don't know of any reasons why they shouldn't exist in great numbers, and I'm confident I shall find vampires who have more in common with me than I with you, vampires who understand knowledge as I do, and have used their superior vampire nature to learn secrets of which you don't even dream. If you haven't told me everything, I shall find things out for myself, or from them, when I find them." He shook his head.
"Louis," he said, "you are in love with your mortal nature. You chase after the phantoms of your former self, Frenier, his sister. These are images for you of what you were and what you still long to be. And in your romance with mortal life, you're dead to your vampire nature."
I objected to this at once.
"My vampire nature has been for me the greatest adventure of my life. All that went before it was confused, clouded. I went through mortal life like a blind man groping from solid object to solid object. It was only when I became a vampire that I respected for the first time all of life. I never saw a living, pulsing human being until I was a vampire. I never knew what life was until it ran out in a red gush over my lips, my hands."
I found myself staring at the two women, the darker one now turning a terrible shade of blue. The blonde was breathing, "She's not dead," I said to him suddenly.
"I know. Let her alone," he said. He lifted her wrist and made a new gash by the scab of the other and filled his glass. "All that you say makes sense," he said to me, taking a drink. "You are an intellect. I've never been. What I've learned from listening to men talk, not from books. I never went to school long enough. But I'm not stupid, and you must listen to me because you are in danger. You do not know your vampire nature. You are like an adult who, looking back on his childhood, realizes that he never appreciated it. You cannot, as a man, go back to the nursery and play with your toys, asking for the love and care to be showered on you again simply because now you know their worth. So it is with you and mortal nature. You've given it up. You no longer look through a glass darkly. But you cannot pass back to the world of human warmth with your new eyes. I know that well enough, I said, but what is it that is our nature? If I can live from the blood of animals, why should I not live from the blood of animals rather than go through the world bringing misery and death to human creatures? Does it bring you happiness? He asked. You wander through the night, feeding on rats like a pauper, and then moon at Babette's window, filled with care, yet helpless as the goddess who came by night to watch Endymion sleep and could not have him. And suppose you could hold her in your arms, and she would look on you without horror or disgust, what then? A few short years to watch her suffer every prick of mortality and then die before your eyes? Does this give happiness? This is insanity, Louis. This is vain. And what truly lies before you is vampire nature, which is killing. For I guarantee you that if you walk the streets tonight and strike down a woman as rich and beautiful as Babette, and suck her blood until she drops at your feet, you will have no hunger left for Babette's profile in the candlelight, or for listening by the window for the sound of her voice. You will be filled, Louis, as you were meant to be, with all the life that you can hold. And you will have hunger when that's gone for the same, and the same, and the same. The red in this glass will be just as red, the roses on the wallpaper just as delicately drawn, and you'll see the moon the same way, and the same the flicker of a candle. And with that same sensibility that you cherish, you will see death in all its beauty, life as it is only known on the very point of death. Don't you understand that, Louis? You alone of all creatures can see death that way, with impunity. You alone, under the rising moon, can strike like the hand of God. He sat back now and drained the glass, and his eyes moved over the unconscious woman. Her breasts heaved and her eyebrows knit as if she were coming round. A moan escaped her lips. He'd never spoken such words to me before, and I had not thought him capable of it. "Vampires are killers," he said now, "predators, whose all-seeing eyes were meant to give them detachment. The ability to see a human life in its entirety, not with any mawkish sorrow, but with a thrilling satisfaction in being the end of that life, in having a hand in the divine plan." "That is how you see it," I protested. The girl moaned again. Her face was very white. Her head rolled against the back of the chair. "That is the way it is," he answered. "You talk of finding other vampires. Vampires are killers. They don't want you or your sensibility. They'll see you coming long before you see them, and they'll see your flaw. And distrusting you, they'll seek to kill you. They'd seek to kill you even if you were like me, because they are lone predators, and seek for companionship no more than cats in the jungle. They're jealous of their secret and of their territory, and if you find one or more of them together, it will be for safety only, and one will be the slave of the other, the way you are of me." "I'm not your slave," I said to him, but even as he spoke I realized I'd been his slave all along.
That's how vampires increase, through slavery. How else? He asked.
He took the girl's wrist again, and she cried out as the knife cut. She opened her eyes slowly as he held her wrist over the glass. She blinked and strained to keep them open. It was as if a veil covered her eyes.
"You're tired, aren't you?"
he asked her. She gazed at him as if she couldn't really see him.
"Tired," he said, now leaning close and staring into her eyes. "You want to sleep?"
"Yes," she moaned softly, and he picked her up and took her into the bedroom. Our coffins rested on the carpet and against the wall. There was a velvet-draped bed. Lestat did not put her on the bed. He lowered her slowly into his coffin.
"What are you doing?"
I asked him, coming to the door sill. The girl was looking around like a terrified child.
"No,"
she was moaning. And then, as he closed the lid, she screamed. She continued to scream within the coffin.
"Why do you do this, Lestat?"
I asked.
"I like to do it," he said. "I enjoy it."
He looked at me.
"I don't say that you have to enjoy it. Take your aesthete's tastes to purer things. Kill them swiftly if you will, but do it. Learn that you are a killer. Ah!"
He threw up his hands in disgust. The girl had stopped screaming. Now he drew up a little curved-legged chair beside the coffin, and crossing his legs he looked at the coffin lid. His was a black varnished coffin, not a pure rectangular box as they are now, but tapered at both ends and widest where the corpse might lay his hands upon his chest. It suggested the human form. It opened, and the girl sat up, astonished, wild-eyed, her lips blue and trembling.
"Lie down, love,"
he said to her, and pushed her back. And she lay, near hysterical, staring up at him.
"You're dead, love,"
he said to her. And she screamed and turned desperately in the coffin, like a fish, as if her body could escape through the sides, through the bottom.
"It's a coffin," she cried. "Let me out!" "But we all must lie in coffins eventually," he said to her. "Lie still, love. This is your coffin. Most of us never get to know what it feels like." "You know what it feels like," he said to her. I couldn't tell whether she was listening or not, or just going wild. But she saw me in the doorway, and then she lay still, looking at Lestat, and then at me.
"Help me," she said to me.
Lestat looked at me. "I expected you to feel these things instinctually, as I did," he said. "When I gave you that first kill, I thought you would hunger for the next and the next, that you would go to each human life as if to a full cup, the way I had. But you didn't. And all this time, I suppose, I kept from straightening you out because you were best, weaker. I'd watch you playing shadow in the night, staring at the falling rain, and I'd think, he's easy to manage, he's simple. But you're weak, Louis. You're a mark. For vampires, and now for humans alike, this thing with Babette has exposed us both. It's as if you want us both to be destroyed."
"I can't stand to watch what you're doing," I said, turning my back. The girl's eyes were burning into my flesh. She lay all the time he spoke, staring at me.
"You can stand it," he said. "I saw you last night with that child. You're a vampire, the same as I am."
He stood up and came towards me. But the girl rose again, and he turned to shove her down.
"Do you think we should make her a vampire? Share our lives with her?"
he asked.
Instantly I said, "No." "Why? Because she's nothing but a whore?" he asked. "A damned expensive whore at that," he said.
"Can she live now? Or has she lost too much?" I asked him.
"Touching," he said. "She can't live." "Then kill her."
She began to scream.
He just sat there.
I turned around. He was smiling, and the girl had turned her face to the satin and was sobbing. Her reason had almost entirely left her. She was crying and praying. She was praying to the Virgin to save her, her hands over her face now, now over her head, the wrist smearing blood in her hair and on the satin. I bent over the coffin. She was dying, it was true. Her eyes were burning, but the tissue around them was already bluish, and now she smiled.
"You won't let me die, will you?" she whispered. "You'll save me."
Lestat reached over and took her wrist.
"But it's too late, love," he said. "Look at your wrist, your breast,"
and then he touched the wound in her throat. She put her hands to her throat and gasped, her mouth open, the scream strangled. I stared at Lestat. I could not understand why he did this. His face was as smooth as mine is now, more animated for the blood, but cold and without emotion. He did not leer like a stage villain, nor hunger for her suffering as if the cruelty fed him. He simply watched her.
"I never meant to be bad," she was crying. "I only did what I had to do. You won't let this happen to me. You'll let me go. I can't die like this. I can't."
She was sobbing, the sobs dry and thin.
"You'll let me go. I have to go to the priest. You'll let me go."
"But my friend is a priest," said Lestat, smiling, as if he'd just thought of it as a joke. "This is your funeral, dear. You see, you were at a dinner party, and you died. But God has given you another chance to be absolved. Don't you see? Tell him your sins."
She shook her head at first, and then she looked at me again with those pleading eyes.
"Is it true?"
she whispered.
"Well," said Lestat, "I suppose you're not contrite, dear. I shall have to shut the lid."
"Stop this, Lestat," I shouted at him. The girl was screaming again, and I could not stand the sight of it any longer. I bent down to her and took her hand.
"I can't remember my sins," she said, just as I was looking at her wrist, resolved to kill her.
"You mustn't try. Tell God only that you are sorry," I said, "and then you'll die and it will be over."
She lay back, and her eyes shut. I sank my teeth into her wrist and began to suck her dry. She stirred once, as if dreaming, and said a name. And then, when I felt her heartbeat reach that hypnotic slowness, I drew back from her, dizzy, confused for the moment, my hands reaching for the doorframe. I saw her as if in a dream. The candles glared in the corner of my eye. I saw her lying utterly still, and Lestat sat composed beside her like a mourner. His face was still.
"Louis," he said to me, "don't you understand? Peace will only come to you when you can do this every night of your life. There is nothing else, but this is everything."
His voice was almost tender as he spoke, and he rose and put both his hands on my shoulders. I walked into the parlor, shying away from his touch, but not resolute enough to push him off.
"Come with me, out into the streets. It's late. You haven't drunk enough. Let me show you what you are, really. Forgive me if I bungled it, left too much to nature. Come."
"I can't bear it, Lestat," I said to him. "You chose your companion badly."
"But Louis," he said, "you haven't tried."
The vampire stopped. He was studying the boy, and the boy, astonished, said nothing.
"It was true what he'd said. I had not drunk enough, and shaken by the girl's fear, I let him lead me out of the hotel, down the back stairs. People were coming now from the Condé Street ballroom, and the narrow street was jammed. There were supper parties in the hotels, and the planter families were lodged in town in great numbers, and we passed through them like a nightmare. My agony was unbearable. Never since I was a human being had I felt
such mental pain. It was because all of Lestat's words had made sense to me. I knew peace only when I killed, only for that minute. And there was no question in my mind that the killing of anything less than a human being brought nothing but a vague longing. The discontent which had brought me close to humans to watch their lives through glass. I was no vampire, and in my pain I asked irrationally, like a child, could I not return? Could I not be human again? Even as the blood of that girl was warm in me, and I felt that physical thrill and strength, I asked that question. The faces of humans passed me like candle flames in the night, dancing on dark waves. I was sinking into the darkness. I was weary of longing. I was turning around and around in the street, looking at the stars and thinking, yes, it's true. I know what he is saying is true, that when I kill there is not longing. And I can't bear this truth. I can't bear it. Suddenly, there was one of those arresting moments. The street was utterly quiet. We had strayed far from the main part of the old town and were near the ramparts. There were no lights, only the fire in a window and the far-off sound of people laughing. But no one here. No one near us. I could feel the breeze suddenly from the river and the hot air of the night rising, and Lestat near me, so still he might have been made of stone. Over the long, low row of pointed roofs were the massive shapes of oak trees in the dark, great, swaying forms of myriad sounds under the low-hung stars. The pain, for the moment, was gone. The confusion was gone. I closed my eyes and heard the wind and the sound of water flowing softly, swiftly in the river. It was enough for one moment. And I knew that it would not endure, that it would fly away from me like something torn out of my arms, and I would fly after it, more desperately lonely than any creature under God, to get it back. And then a voice beside me rumbled deep in the sound of the night, a drumbeat as the moment ended, saying, "Do what it is your nature to do. This is but a taste of it. Do what it is your nature to do." And the moment was gone. I stood, like the little girl in the parlor in the hotel, dazed and ready for the slightest suggestion. I was nodding at Lestat as he nodded at me. "Pain is terrible for you," he said. "You feel it like no other creature because you are a vampire. You don't want it to go on." "No," I answered him. "I'll feel as I felt with her. Wed to her and weightless, caught as if by a dance, that and more." His hand tightened on mine. "Don't turn away from it. Come with me." He led me quickly through the street, turning every time I hesitated, his hand out for mine, a smile on his lips, his presence as marvelous to me as the night he'd come in my mortal life and told me we would be vampires. "Evil is a point of view," he whispered now. "We are immortal, and what we have before us are the rich feasts that conscience cannot appreciate and mortal men cannot know without regret. God kills, and so shall we. Indiscriminately he takes the richest and the poorest, and so shall we. For no creatures under God are as we are. None so like him as ourselves, dark angels not confined to the stinking limits of hell, but wandering his earth and all its kingdoms. I want a child tonight. I am like a mother. I want a child." I should have known what he meant. I did not. He had me mesmerized, enchanted. He was playing to me as he had when I was a mortal. He was leading me. He was saying, "Your pain will end." We'd come to a street of lighted windows. It was a place of rooming houses, sailors, flatboat men. We entered a narrow door, and then, in a hollow stone passage in which I could hear my own breath like the wind, he crept along the wall until his shadow leapt out in the light of a doorway beside the shadow of another man, their heads bent together, their whispers like the rustling of dry leaves. "What is it?" I drew near him as he came back, afraid suddenly this exhilaration in me would die. I saw again that nightmare landscape I'd seen when I spoke with Babette. I felt the chill of loneliness, the chill of guilt.
"She's there," he said. "Your wounded one. Your daughter."
"What do you say? What are you talking about?"
"You've saved her," he whispered. "I knew it. You left the window wide on her and her dead mother, and people passing in the street brought her here."
"The child? The little girl?" I gasped.
But he was already leading me through the door to stand at the end of the long ward of wooden beds, each with a child beneath a narrow white blanket, one candle at the end of the ward where a nurse bent over a small desk. We walked down the aisle between the rows.
"Starving children, orphans," he said. "Children of plague and fever."
He stopped. I saw the little girl lying in the bed. And then the man was coming, and he was whispering with Lestat. Such care for the sleeping little ones. Someone in another room was crying. The nurse rose and hurried away. And now the doctor bent and wrapped the child in the blanket. Lestat had taken money from his pocket and set it on the foot of the bed. The doctor was saying how glad he was we'd come for her. How most of them were orphans. They came in on the ship, sometimes orphans too young even to tell which body was that of their mother. He thought Lestat was the father. And in moments Lestat was running through the streets with her, the white of the blanket gleaming against his dark coat and cape. And even to my expert vision as I ran after him, it seemed sometimes as if the blanket flew through the night with no one holding it. A shifting shape traveling on the wind like a leaf stood upright and sent scurrying along a passage, trying to gain the wind all the while and truly take flight.
I caught him, finally, as we approached the lamps near the Place d'Armes.
The child lay pale on his shoulder, her cheeks still full like plums, though she was drained and near death. She opened her eyes, or rather the lids slid back, and beneath the long curling lashes I saw a streak of white.
"Lestat, what are you doing? Where are you taking her?" I demanded, but I knew too well.
He was heading for the hotel, and meant to take her into our room. The corpses were as we left them, one neatly set in the coffin as if an undertaker had already attended her, the other in her chair at the table. Lestat brushed past them as if he didn't see them, while I watched him in fascination. The candles had all burned down, and the only light was that of the moon and the street. I could see his iced and gleaming profile as he set the child down on the pillow.
"Come here, Louis. You haven't fed enough. I know you haven't,"
he said with the same calm, convincing voice he had used skillfully all evening. He held my hand in his own warm and tight.
"See her, Louis. How plump and sweet she looks, as if even death can't take her freshness. The will to live is too strong. He might make a sculpture of her tiny lips and rounded hands, but he cannot make her fade. You remember the way you wanted her when you saw her in that room?"
I resisted him. I didn't want to kill her. I hadn't wanted to last night. And then suddenly I remembered two conflicting things and was torn in agony. I remembered the powerful beating of her heart against mine, and I hungered for it so badly I turned my back on her in the bed and would have rushed out of the room had not Lestat held me fast. And I remembered her mother's face, and that moment of horror when I dropped the child and he'd come into the room. But he wasn't mocking me now. He was confusing me.
"You want her, Louis. Don't you see? Once you've taken her, then you can take whomever you wish." You wanted her last night, but you weakened, and that's why she's not dead.
I could feel it was true, what he said.
I could feel again that ecstasy of being pressed to her, her little heart going and going. She's too strong for me. Her heart, it wouldn't give up, I said to him. Is she so strong? He smiled. He drew me close to him. Take her, Louis, I know you want her.
And I did. I drew close to the bed now and just watched her.
Her chest barely moved with her breath, and one small hand was tangled in her long gold hair.
I couldn't bear it, looking at her, wanting her not to die and wanting her. And the more I looked at her, the more I could taste her skin, feel my arm sliding under her back and pulling her up to me, feeling her soft neck. Soft. Soft. That's what she was. So soft. I tried to tell myself it was best for her to die. What was to become of her? But these were lying thoughts. I wanted her. And so I took her in my arms and held her, her burning cheek on mine, her hair falling down over my wrists and brushing my eyelids, the sweet perfume of a child strong and pulsing in spite of sickness and death.
She moaned now, stirred in her sleep, and that was more than I could bear. I'd kill her before I'd let her wake and know it.
I went into her throat and heard Lestat saying to me, strangely, "Just a little tear, it's just a little throat." And I obeyed him. I won't tell you again what it was like, except that it caught me up just as it had done before, and as killing always does, only more, so that my knees bent and I half lay on the bed, sucking her dry, that heart pounding again that would not slow, would not give up.
And suddenly, as I went on and on, the instinctual part of me waiting, waiting for the slowing of the heart, which would mean death, Lestat wrenched me from her.
"But she's not dead," I whispered. But it was over. The furniture of the room emerged from the darkness. I sat, stunned, staring at her, too weak to move, my head rolling back against the headboard of the bed, my hands pressing down on the velvet spread. Lestat was snatching her up, talking to her, saying a name. "Claudia, Claudia, listen to me. Come round, Claudia." He was carrying her now out of the bedroom into the parlour, and his voice was so soft I barely heard him. "You're ill, do you hear me? You must do as I tell you to get well." And then, in the pause that followed, I came to my senses. I realized what he was doing, that he had cut his wrist and given it to her, and she was drinking. "That's it, dear. More," he was saying to her. "You must drink it to get well." "Damn you!" I shouted, and he hissed at me with blazing eyes. He sat on the settee with her locked to his wrist. I saw her white hand clutching at his sleeve, and I could see his chest heaving for breath and his face contorted the way I'd never seen it. He let out a moan and whispered again to her to go on. And when I moved from the threshold, he glared at me again as if to say, "I'll kill you."
"But why, Lestat?" I whispered to him.
He was trying now to push her off, and she wouldn't let go. With her fingers locked around his fingers and arm, she held the wrist to her mouth, a growl coming out of her.
"Stop! Stop!" he said to her.
He was clearly in pain. He pulled back from her and held her shoulders with both hands. She tried desperately to reach his wrist with her teeth, but she couldn't. And then she looked at him with the most innocent astonishment. He stood back, his hand out, lest she move. Then he clapped a handkerchief on his wrist and backed away from her toward the bell rope. He pulled it sharply, his eyes still fixed on her.
"What have you done, Lestat?" I asked him. "What have you done?"
I stared at her. She sat composed, revived, filled with life, no sign of pallor or weakness in her, her legs stretched out straight on the damask, her white gown soft and thin like an angel's gown around her small form.
She was looking at Lestat.
"Not me," he said to her. "Ever again. Do you understand? But I'll show you.